Hey everybody, it's Max. This week, Pat and I are joined by friend of the show, Zach Gage, a game designer from New York, one of my favorite game designers, and we continue our conversation from last week about game design. This is another very boring, game-heavy episode, but it's just, I guess, the thing that Pat and I are kind of obsessed about right now. I think this episode came out better than the last one because we're actually joined by someone who knows what they're talking about. But in fact, the conversation was so good and lasted so long that we felt that we needed to split this episode into two parts. So this week, please enjoy the first half of our conversation. We'll be back next week with the second half. And while those are playing, Pat and I will be hanging out in Seattle at PAX, and we'll try and record a couple of episodes in person, not about video games, and those will be out in the next couple of weeks. Talk to you guys soon.
Hey.
How is it going?
You know, as soon as I said, hey, I wanted to apologize for the disingenuousness of my hey. I tried to sound like really enthusiastic, but I was lying to you and to our listeners. I feel just like absolutely pounded flat. I don't know what the deal is I've been up for.
Even mining too much hebronium.
Maybe. Is it that, Max, or is it that I have not mined enough hebronium?
I gotta keep going. Only one way to find out.
Do I come through the other side? I don't know what it is. I have a coffee here and a tea, and I've been awake for at least an hour and a half, which is pretty good for me lately, even though we're filming around 1 in the afternoon. But I feel truly, truly stupid, like somebody has like legitimately struck me in the head.
Well... I'm having a good day, actually. I have, like, good energy level. I went to my personal trainer, Todd, yesterday, and he had me, like, throwing a tire around and running and doing all kinds of terrible, painful things, but I feel pretty good today.
There's probably a lesson to be learned here. But what that lesson is, I just have no idea.
Well, my cocktail of Claret & D and coffee is, like, I'm like at the peak right now. Like I'm just sort of like slowly trying to keep coffee intake steady for the rest of the day without like tipping over to the edge into like having a panic attack. Like I'm right on that line. Well, before we get too far into this, we are joined by a very special guest this week, friend of the show, New York game designer Zach Gage.
Hello.
Hey, Zach.
Hello.
Zach is an old friend of mine from basically as long as I've sort of been a part of the games scene and the games world. Zach is, I would say, first kind of a fine artist or a digital artist and got into making games. And he's sort of one of my favorite people in terms of like a speaker and a writer about games, and also very frustratingly one of the best actual game designers. Usually people are good at one or the other of those things, but Zach is good at both, and it's very upsetting. And I believe a big Name of the Wind fan as well.
Oh yeah.
Well, that got you in the door right there, where I was like, I don't know about this New York game designer. Although, you know what's funny, Max, as soon as you said that you found his skill irritating, I went, oh, okay. Like that's where I went, okay, I want to hear what this guy has to say, because that's sort of my qualifier when somebody...
Oh, but Jesus Christ, hold on. Sorry.
Busy, what a busy man. Wait, let's hear what Zach got.
Sorry, delivery.
What is it? Who is it?
I don't know. Something fun, I hope. One second.
Okay. This is very exciting. This is that fast-paced New York life, Pat. We'll never understand it.
I can't imagine what it must be like. Fancy doorbells. Here they just have to pound on the door.
They just leave the package right out on the lawn.
Pretty much. They just throw it out the window as they drive by my house.
Yeah.
But the people... It's getting to the point where when I review books... Pretty much like the best review I can think of giving is that I kind of, after reading a book, I kind of hate the person a little bit.
You know who that is for me nowadays is Lydia Davis. Do you know her?
No, I don't.
Oh my God, you'd like her. She is well known for doing like micro fiction, micro prose. So she does these like
very short, you know, just several lines, but every word is, it's almost a kind of poetry slash prose. I mean, it's, her stuff is just, it just stops me in my tracks. Like, I'm like arrested when I read it, and I'm like, sometimes I get mad. I'm like, oh my God, like, that is so smart and good. I will never write anything that good.
I'm back. It was a delivery not for me. for a different floor.
So tell me, so Pat, I'm curious. So here's how I feel about Zach, and I'm curious if you feel the same is true of authors that you've encountered. So often in the world of games, there's sort of people who are they like practice game design and they make games, and they're really like the in my opinion some of the best game designers are the most intuitive, and they very frustratingly they have the least to say about their process of making games. So like an example would be Beau Blythe, who I think is one of my favorite game designers and made Samurai Gun. Like, Beau's a genius, and he's one of the I think he's one of the best living game designers. And he there's a thing in game design called game feel, which is sort of that like ineffable, like how does it feel to use the game. And Beau is probably maybe the best living person at that, or also JW from Vlambeer. But neither of them, when you ask them like, how did you do this, they both just sort of shrug and they're like, I don't know, I just did it until it was right and then it was done. they don't have anything like interesting to say about it. On the other hand, there's like game academics, and they publish books and essays, and they have tons of, they could write on and on and on about game feel, but they're not so good at making games. And Zach is like, it's very frustrating because he makes really good games and they're very conceptual. Like, they always start with this crazy mechanic or idea, and I'm like, and I always roll my eyes and I'm like, that's never going to turn into a good game. And then it does. It turns into a really fun, good game.
Max, you didn't tell me you'd be complimenting me on this podcast. I don't
yeah,
know
get
if
used
I would
to it,
have
buddy.
Agreed to be here.
You know, in writing, some of the terminology that gets thrown around is you're an architect or you're a gardener. And it sounds like kind of what you're describing a similar thing there. I tend to think of it almost more like you're an organic writer or you're a bricklayer. And because I've read some books that are, you know, really good, like, but you can tell that this person like laid down brick after brick after brick after brick after brick after brick. And it just feels very deliberate, and they've constructed a book, and you're like, boy, that is absolutely a book. And some of the concepts or whatever are really wonderful in there. But then, you know, there are other books, you know, that I read and I'm like, how did you do that? Like the Last Unicorn is one of those books. And I look at that and, you know, Peter Beagle talks about it, and he talks about how it was a huge pain in the ass to write. But he doesn't say, oh, I did it this way, I did it that way. There is kind of a similar thing in writing.
I often hear authors that I like, they say things that are really frustrating, like, well, I just listened to the characters and they told me where they needed to go.
Oh,
and I'm like, how do I implement that? I'm like, how do I utilize, I think that's useless to me. Like, I don't hear my character, you know, I don't ever hear anything just speak to me and write it down.
Now, I will say that is when that irritates me, but in a different way, because it promotes, and I'm sorry, but like, I gotta nip that shit in the bud right here. If I don't talk about it now, we'll miss this moment. When people say like, oh, my characters just took off with the story, what I always think about is like when you go to a restaurant and there's some parents there with their kids, and the kids are like just tearing around like fucking little demons, right? And they're knocking over the potted fern and they're making noise and they're crawling underneath the tables. And you look at the parents and the parents are like, ha ha ha, you know, I just can't do anything with them. You know, oh, they're, you know. And back before I was a parent, I would look at those people and I would think, you can do something. You can do your fucking job as a parent and corral your fucking spawn. And now that I am a parent,
your brood.
Yes, right? And now that I am a parent, right, I look at those people and I think the exact fucking same thing. You know? Because, yeah, you do your job and it's not easy, but you have to, like, manage your children so that they can be part of civilization. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to be perfect, but you don't let them run roughshod over your entire life. And similarly, when people, like when authors say, oh, the characters, they just ran away with the story, or, oh, they took this scene in a different direction. I know where they're coming from. I've experienced that as well. And it is sort of, it's a cool thing when you're inspired and it all happens very naturally. But there are also times when I'm writing and somebody says something in a scene and I look at what they've just said and I'm like, now that they have said this thing, there is going to be a response that will destroy relationships in this book. You know, that they are going to fight and disagree. And like this is going to be cataclysmic in this book socially. Like people will no longer be able to be friends with the fight that this will precipitate. But here's the thing. I don't just say, oh, well, I guess I better move forward with the story because this is what the character had to say. No, I am in charge. This is me. I have to figure out, you know, and then it could be you go back a couple of lines and you look at it and you're like, well, he had to say this because this was said here. Sometimes you have to unravel, you know, 2,000 words. You have to go back to a previous chapter to stop that conversation from happening entirely. But you do it. You, as the author, you're not some sort of, I don't know, vessel for the muse. That whole myth of the author as vehicle for the story to move through you, that shit pisses me off because to the point of being inarticulate, that myth of the author shit really pisses me off because it sort of removes responsibility from the author, which means at the same time it removes, like, you got to admire an author who pulls their shit off and does a good job. And if you treat the author like, you know, like a horse that a Loa is riding, that's that kind of disenfranchises and belittles the craft of the writer.
Well, I think also, you know, another parallel to game design is like they're very strongly with writing is there is this sort of mythology of like the auteur artist, which is like this genius comes along and they do everything themselves and they have the purity of their vision and their execution and they nail it. And it's a direct sort of outpouring of their genius into the work. And you have this like, it's like a quasi like romantic era, like relationship with art where it's like a view of art that comes from like Kant, right? Where it's like the spirit is in the art and you unveil it and you train your gaze upon the art and the spirit enters you. And that's like a godly experience. And I just don't think that holds up to scrutiny. To steer this back towards the topic that we want to talk about, like one of the things I love about Zach's talks in particular is like I think he's very insightful into that process and in a way that really enables people to think not like, oh, well, I'll never make a good game because I'm not a genius, but rather, you know, what makes a game designer a genius is that they put in a lot of hard work and they think really critically, and I too can do that. That's just working hard, right?
Well, one of the things that I was going to say about what Pat just said, which is super fascinating, and I had no idea that writing was like that, is that there are so many parallels in game design, and so much of game design is like fumbling around in a big dark space and trying to like find the fun thing. And sometimes the things that you find are like things that fit with all of the other stuff that you found and like contribute to the shape of the game that you're going for. And sometimes you find things that are incredibly fun that don't fit and you need to learn how to sort of manage that. And also vice versa, sometimes you find fun things that end up ruining the experience for players because of how players are learning to play the game, and this fun thing that you found is actually pointing them in the wrong direction or confusing them, and then you have to either ditch it or figure out how to change it. So it's very much a similar experience of managing the structure that's evolving in front of you.
I have to say that's a very good way of saying it, because like, and again, there's a huge parallel to writing where it's not just like you draft something and then you take out all the shit bits, you know, and then all that's left is brilliant story. It's so not like that. I think of it as the kind of the naive sculpture model where like you vomit forth a million words of text and then chisel away at everything that doesn't look like an elephant, right?
This is how, like, John Scalzi looks at a slab of marble and he sees Old Man's War and he just chisels away until all that's left is the book.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's absolutely not that way. There was, and I can't remember the name of the essayist or the essay itself, you know, and not that I read essays, but this was way back in high school. We read the essay and it was about, I think it was a woman who went down to South America and had some adventures. And the whole thing kind of revolves around the fact that they go to this little village and there's like an antelope tied to a tree, and then they kill and eat this, not an antelope, but, you know, like a small deer-like creature, and they kill and eat it. And it's, you know, it's this interesting essay, and it's the sort of thing you have to read in high school, right? Not necessarily up my alley. But what was really interesting is then after reading it and talking about it, we listened to an interview with her about the essay. And she said, I wrote it. And one of the things that happened on this trip, she said, we stopped at a bar, and in the bar there was a tank with a piranha in it, and it was a vegetarian piranha. And the interviewer laughs and says, what? And he goes, yeah, the person, you know, you could buy a stalk of celery and you would put it in the tank and this piranha would demolish this stalk of celery. It was fascinating to watch. And it was so interesting. I kept putting it in the essay because how could I not include that? And she's like, finally somebody read it and they're like, this is the thing you have to get rid of. You have to take this. She goes, but I love that part. And he goes, yeah, it's a great bit, but it's ruining the essay. It's ruining this story that you're telling. But Zach, what you just mentioned is true. You can have, and I have experienced this where sometimes there's something great in this game. Like they've included this brilliant little mechanic that then just screws everything. It inflates your expectation to a weird degree, or it can poison. Hell, let's mix our metaphors like really thoroughly. It's like the wrong flavor in an otherwise wonderful soup.
One thing that I actually was thinking about from listening to your guys' podcast last week and listening to what you were saying about No Man's Sky and Max, what your experience was with Spelunky, is I have this not broadly accepted definition of where the art is in games, because for years it was a stupid conversation about like what's art, and everybody wants games to be art, and then games are in the MoMA, but for like some weird reason. And so I thought a ton about, and also so many people have asked me this question because I come from art, so they're like, oh, this person maybe has an idea. So I thought about it a lot, and it kind of relates to the thing that Pat just said, which is for me, like, the artistic component of a game is the space that the game builds for your brain to explore, and it's like the seamless, invisible space. And so my example of like how you understand what that space is if you like take Mario Brothers and you play it, and you take Grand Theft Auto and you play it, nobody will ever accuse Mario Brothers of being unrealistic, even though Mario Brothers is completely unrealistic. But the person who plays Grand Theft Auto and can't open a door, like if they're playing Grand Theft Auto 3, they drive by a building, they want to go inside the building, and then they can't, then they'll go, oh, this game is unrealistic. But what's happening there is they're running up against the wall of the space that the game has created for them to explore. And I think the most beautiful games are the ones where those walls are very difficult to see or are never seen, and they're just these sort of weird guiding hands around what you're thinking and what you're exploring. And so... for what Pat just said, I think, you know, you've played a lot of games where you have that experience of running into the wall. And I think that's a craft issue.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, I talked about this literally less than 2 hours ago, except it was in my world where, and sorry, Max, but I was being a little critical of Harry Potter because...
How dare you.
Yeah, sorry. But, you know, there... A lot of the walls in Harry Potter, if you think about, you know, you do run into those walls. You see those walls, as opposed to, like, one of my favorite examples when I'm talking about story and effectively genre. Genre and genre convention, the ability to understand and navigate those waters is super important. And I'm not talking about sci-fi fantasy, urban fantasy. They're kind of bigger issues than that, where, you know, very few people think of folktale or fairy tale as a specific genre. But the fact is, if you start reading Little Red Riding Hood and she's walking through the forest and then a wolf comes up to her and talks, here's the interesting thing. Nobody ever says, whoa, 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 whoa. Wolves can't talk. Like, that doesn't happen. And, you know... And similarly, like, you move forward in that story, and then, like, nobody really questions. It's like, how can she not tell that this is a wolf in the bed? Or when they cut open, when the woodsman comes out and cuts open her belly and the grandmother jumps out, nobody's like, whoa, 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 whoa. That's not how digestion works. You know, it's because in the realm of that folktale, that fairy tale, the rules of the world are different, and it's internally consistent to those rules. You know, and I think part of the problem with the Harry Potter series is that it starts out very much, that first book is really beautiful, and it engages in, it almost exists in that fairy tale, folktale space that like Roald Dahl wandered into occasionally with Willy Wonka or the BFG, where, you know, Harry lives under the stairs, and you don't question that. Like, he lived in this little room under the stairs, and you don't go, whoa, 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 hold on. Child services would be all over that shit. But it starts in this fairy tale world, and then it tries to kind of transition into, like, this gritty, realistic, warlike, dystopian something, and it gets kind of, you know, there's, I don't know, some Mengele shit that happens to that, to the genre it tries to occupy, because it's got one foot in each world, and so expectations get really, really jinky.
Well, there's an idea in tabletop design that kind of reminds me of this, which is the more when you're working on a board game. There's this weird perverse effect of, like, the more rules the game has and the more specific the rules are, the easier it is for the players to find loopholes and fight about the rules. Because, like, if you have 100 rules, that is 100 opportunities for someone to, like, exploit the rules and find a loophole in the way that's not in the spirit of the rules. Whereas if the rules are very simple, the players tend to sort of self-enforce not exploiting the spirit of the rules. And, you know, you can never catch in a board game, you can never, obviously, you know, you're not there, so you can't stop people from cheating or from exploiting loopholes. So, like, I'll use a very specific example in my new game, Secret Hitler. So in Secret Hitler, there's a moment where two players, the president draws these cards and passes them to the chancellor, and there's a chance that both the president and the chancellor are, like, the good guys, but they draw bad cards and they look terrible to the group. And so there's a temptation, if you're the president and the chancellor, to, like, basically telegraph to the group how upset you are that you got bad cards, and people go, they're overacting and they're slapping their knees and they're, like, hanging their heads in shame and, like, oh, like, I can't believe the cards they got. And then when they finally reveal them, it's like they've now, like, sort of primed everyone and set everyone up to understand how disappointed they are. And as we were playtesting, we kept seeing players come up with new ways to avoid incriminating themselves, and we would write a rule about that. So we were like, okay, you can't talk while you're passing. So then players would do it all silently. So then we're like, you can't talk or telegraph what you're thinking when you pass it. So then someone actually figured out, if they got three bad cards that they didn't like, they would sort of, what they figured out was, they blindly shuffled them, looked away, and randomly passed two cards to the chancellor to telegraph to the table, I don't care what the cards are. And we're like, whoa, this is brilliant. I was like, we can never, it's like whack-a-mole. We will never solve all the ways players will come up with to do this. So the solution is, in the rules, it says something to the effect of, the intention, from our point of view, our intention as game designers is for the other players at the table to have no idea what you drew. So don't do anything that is obnoxious, that tells that is trying to telegraph to people what you drew. And that kind of solved it, because we instead of saying, well, don't do these 30 specific things, and inviting people to come up with the 31st thing, we were just like, here's what we believe in.
That is awesome.
So just to, and the way that like that connects to what you're talking about, Pat, with these basically like systems, is like, I think in a way, when I read the magic system or the rune system in that you start to learn about in the academy at like Name of the Wind, there's a part of my brain as a reader that's like, well, I'm going to get you. Like, I'll find the little inconsistency. Like, as soon as you make it a hard system of rules, it's like, I want to find the contradiction or find the logical inconsistency in it. Whereas in a system, you know, like you're saying, with like a fairy tale or something more broad, it's like, it never even occurs to me to pick it apart.
Yeah, because it is kind of unassailable. That's one of the benefits of that poetic or that numinous type of magic. Nobody ever says, well, and actually I was going to say something, but then I would have argued immediately against it. Like, nobody ever says, oh, nuh-uh, Gandalf couldn't do that, because you don't know specifically. But the truth is, you don't know specifically. There's no explicit rules laid down for Gandalf, except if Gandalf did cast magic missile, it would feel wrong. Because, you know, you might not have an explicit system of rules laid down, but there is an implicit system of rules.
I cast a prismatic spray for 25 damage and a dice roll against the Balrog.
Exactly. If Gandalf had said, oh, I've already used up all my third level spells, you'd be like, what?
I do want to come to the defense of Harry Potter to just say, I agree with your like assessment that first book, everything is so strange and mystical and unexplained, and it's really delightful. And by the seventh book, the system is very systematized, and there's lots of rules, and you're really seeing the walls of that world. But I think it totally works because it's a coming of age story, and it's a story about how you go from a child and having wonder at the world and everything being sort of dark and random and frightening to becoming an adult and learning the rules that govern the world.
Ooh, I agree with that. However, that's not the problem, because the time turner is not an issue. The problems with the time turner realizing there are problems with the concept of the time turner is not a coming of age issue. You know, the time turner is just like a dumb thing to include in the story.
Oh, see, now I feel like you're complaining that Gandalf is out of third level spells.
No, it's because here's what happens. When you insert something like that into the book, where people actually have the ability to legitimately manipulate time, right? Dumbledore, gives this to Hermione, and then nobody ever uses it for anything else.
Because they smash it.
No,
Oh, I got you.
No, this means either Dumbledore is a fucking idiot for giving this incredibly powerful problem-solving tool to a little girl so that she can study more. Which you got to admit, if there's only one of these, then that is a fucking dumb call. And is Dumbledore dumb? Is he dumb, Max?
Occasionally, yes. Occasionally, when he like sends students into the woods that's where the werewolves are murdering unicorns, just as like a detention, that is pretty dumb.
Okay, and now you see the whole system start to unravel, where it's like, do they constantly jeopardize the lives of children?
Unless, wait, but what about this? Maybe Gandalf is playing some fucking Donald Trump 4D chess, and he wanted Harry to be in the woods so he could learn the mystery of the unicorns, and he wanted Hermione to have the time turner so that she could, because he knew that there would be some confrontation at the end of the story, right?
Oh, ah. Dumbledore is the Sith, is what you're...
Yes.
No, it's the fact that, and here's what happens, and this happens a lot. You know, what the time turner is, this cool idea that when you insert it into the world, it causes more problems than it solves narratively. Not in the story, but outside the story. The story outside the story this belief framework and this expectation.
But what about your dumb tree that prohibits all the characters from making decisions and having free will?
No, actually, what it opens up is a discussion about those subjects. Bast and Chronicler delve into that, where it's a very big, you know, is it, isn't it, do they, don't they sort of situation. Bast believes one thing, Chronicler believes another, but you just don't know which as the reader.
Did either of you guys read Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality?
Yes, you turned me onto this, and it's my favorite thing in the world. So, I love this.
Pat, are you familiar with this?
I've had it recommended by a lot of people that I really like. Part of the problem is, like, I don't read things off screens, and I don't think you can just buy it as a book because it'd be a flagrant.
I'll print it out and mail it to you.
It's basically like somebody was like, yeah, the time turner is a problem, but what if it was awesome? And then they basically explore it as if the time turner is like for real. And almost the whole book is about the time turner.
The premise is like, what if before coming to Hogwarts, Harry was really well versed in the scientific method, and when he got to Hogwarts, he was amazed that nobody in the wizard world applies the scientific method to sort of deduce the limits of magic and the rules of magic, and it's like right straddling that line of like genius and crazy, where it's like a little uncomfortable to read at times. Because the guy who wrote it is clearly like a mad genius, but it's an amazing deconstruction of Harry Potter, where he like reverse engineers all the rules of the magical world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is, and I'll say it, I have to bring it up whenever I talk about Harry Potter, cause it seems like I'm really down on it. You know, it's not my favorite series. I enjoyed it, you know, well enough. And it came into my life, those first four books, when I really kind of needed like a fun, fluffy story. I was in grad school at the time, you know, and like not quite ready to put a gun in my mouth, but I'm glad that I didn't have a gun. Let's just put it that way. I very much enjoyed the books, but, you know, and I don't hold it against anyone who loves them with a passionate love. But the thing is, with love makes us dumb. And when you love something sometimes passionately, you know, what it does is it makes you blind to the faults of the thing that you love. And this is super useful, right? Like, yeah, like look at my relationship. Like, do you think if Sarah did not love me in a crazy way that she could tolerate like half of my bullshit? And similarly, you know, narratively, there's a ton of problems in Harry Potter, you know, in terms of the cohesion of the world, the inconsistency of the rules, the fact that, you know, a bunch of things are presented as true, and then those decisions are reversed in later books, or the very simple, the simple permutations of certain things existing in the world are never followed through on. You know, and I'm not saying that you should not love it because of these things. I'm just saying that those things are there. And a lot of times when people go to great lengths, you know, to try to explain away those things, it kind of comes across in like a relationship where somebody goes, you know, I've noticed that Jerry kind of talks down to you a lot. And then he's like, oh no, you don't understand. It's just that he, you know, and it's like, well, I've noticed you're really quiet around Jerry an awful lot. He's like, oh, no, you don't understand. It's what it kind of comes down to is, you know, either you say, I love it despite its flaws, or you end up sounding like somebody who's stuck in a really bad relationship and just like, oh, you don't know what it's like when we're alone. You kind of can't make the time turner okay. And that's fine. You can still love the books and acknowledge that as a flaw. But I feel like my job as a writer is to make a reader have to, like, I don't want the reader to have to explain away my mistakes. I want to fix my mistakes, make as few mistakes as possible, so that somebody that loves my book doesn't feel the need to, like, explain away the problems.
All right. I'm now transitioning this conversation. It's happening. I'm taking command of this conversation. So last, what's that?
Good segue.
Oh, thank you. It's some of my best work. Okay, so last week on the podcast, in a little segment that I edited out, Pat, you and I started talking about The Witness, which was we had both mentioned that as a game that we played this year, and we both really enjoyed and got a lot out of. And we were specifically interested. So first of all, spoiler, if anyone hasn't played The Witness and you care about spoilers, spoilers for the whole game and the rest of this conversation. The Witness is a game that's about the, I would say to the extent that that game is sort of about anything or has a story is sort of philosophically about anything. It's about pedagogy. It's a game that is all about learning these puzzles. And then it's what it's about is how it's teaching you these puzzles. So it kind of invites you to think about it and pick it apart, much in the same way that you're talking about with the time turner of like it's basically like, you know, there's like a, it's so specific in its discussion of pedagogy that it's inviting you to be like, think about this, right? Like, consider it. So I've asked Zach to join us to talk about this idea of like pedagogy in games, where we started to go down this rabbit hole last week, and I was like, really, neither of us know what we're talking about. We got to get Zach on here. And specifically, I was hoping we could start with Zach gave this talk. It's one of my all-time favorite game talks. It's from a conference called Practice in 2014, and the title of the talk is Design for Problem Solvers. I'll put all the links to this in the show notes, but listeners, you can find Zach's talks, and including this Designing for Problem Solvers talk, at Zach's website, which is stfj.net/text. But I was hoping just to sort of like kick off our witness conversation, Zach could sort of go through some of the ideas of that pedagogy talk.
Yeah, sure. I'll try to do this as briefly as possible. But there's a couple like concepts that are kind of important, and I hope it's not too dry. But the sort of core of the whole discussion of pedagogy, and in fact, the core of the talk was really this idea of like, how do we build language around how we talk about difficulty in games? Because so much of games revolves around the concept of difficulty. Like, games are sort of in every concept, a struggle or an interaction with a person. And when you have struggles or interactions, the accessibility and difficulty of those interactions is really important. And it turns out that in game design, there really aren't a tremendous number of terms for talking about this stuff, especially, and part of that is because we kind of have a limited vocabulary. But it turns out that the other part of it is that there's actually a very limited mindset in terms of how we approach this stuff. So with that extremely dry beginning, here's some dry terms. So the most important things to be able to talk about when you're talking about this are this idea of a routine problem and a non-routine problem. So for example, a routine problem is something that you would know how to solve when you see it based on past experience. So to pull right from the talk, something like 567 times 46 is a routine problem because you know exactly the steps you have to do to solve that. It doesn't mean that the problem's easy. You know, you probably don't know the answer to 567 times 46 off the top of your head, but it's routine in that, like, if you probably know how to do multiplication, and if you sat down and did it, you would get the right answer. A non-routine problem is something for which when you look at it, you don't know the obvious solution. So for example, again, from the talk, a cycle shop has a total of 36 bicycles and tricycles in stock. Collectively, there are 80 wheels. How many bikes and trikes are there? So like, that's a problem where you have to sit down and look at it and think about the components. And it's a super boring math problem that you've probably seen when you were in like eighth grade. But it's pretty clear that like that problem, roughly the same difficulty as the multiplication problem, but one that you don't have like a thing that you can reference in your memory to figure out how to solve.
Well, and just to clarify there, I really don't want to sideline this, but I want to make sure that I'm clear on these terms, because sure. I guess it's going to be instrumental here. So have you done No Man's Sky?
Yes.
So a routine problem would be, say, my ship is damaged, and it says you need these four components, you know, and 500 units of hebrium. And so I look at that, and I'm like, I know how to get hebrium. It's just a matter of me finding it and mining it and then bringing it back to the ship.
Right. Yeah. A routine problem in No Man's Sky is like, my suit is running out of energy, and I know that I need plutonium to fill it up. So I'm going to open up my inventory and fill it up with plutonium.
Yeah, and could you throw out a non-routine problem?
Sure. Well, so a non-routine problem would be a lot of what No Man's Sky initially presents you with. So, like, when you first get into No Man's Sky and you're like, I want to get into space. And then, like, I don't know how to get into space. Like, I have to look around this world. I have to look at what the ship is asking for. I have to follow a bunch of directions and try to figure out what those things mean. That is more of a non-routine problem. But it's difficult to truly formulate a non-routine problem in No Man's Sky because No Man's Sky adheres to the general philosophy of how games are taught, which is very different and actually, which is very different than when you're dealing with non-routine problems. And that specifically ties into, like, a lot of the stuff that The Witness does.
Oh, a non-routine problem in No Man's Sky would be, like, what am I doing with my life? How am I spending my time? Oh, how did this game get so much hype? What was their press strategy?
Well, might it be, like, how do I move on to the next system? You know, because that's one that stymied me because there was a bug in the game where I swapped ships and so I had no fuel. So it says, you know, hyperdrive to wherever the hell. And I'm like, yeah, I got no gas for that thing. And so I knew that I needed to put gas in the thing, but I had no idea how to get the gas. Might that qualify? Yep. I just really want to nail down the distinction.
Yeah, I think a general rule for understanding what a non-routine problem is it's not something you know how to solve. And in fact, it's something that you probably have to model in some degree in your head to be to understand how to solve it. So, for example, with the bicycle shop, you would be like, okay, well, I have all these things. How many wheels do all these things have? Well, bikes have two wheels and tricycles have three wheels. And so maybe is there anything I can solve for here with the 80 wheels? That's sort of, whereas like with the plutonium suit refilling example, it's like there's a thing you have to solve for, like, oh shoot, I don't have any plutonium, I guess I need to find a red crystal, and then you go find one, and then you have the plutonium, and then you put it in your suit. So you still have to solve it, but you know exactly what the steps are.
Cool.
So the key thing with non-routine and routine problems is that you can actually break most of humanity down into people who are great at solving non-routine problems and people who are not great at solving non-routine problems. And we call people who are great at solving non-routine problems problem solvers. They're expert problem solvers. And everybody else is not an expert problem solver. And this is a really big thing in like the 60s through the 80s in educational research was a big component of it was like, how do we turn people into expert problem solvers? Because if we can make people into expert problem solvers, then they'll be able to teach themselves whatever it is they want to do. And as an interesting aside, in video games, we actually have a dearth of expert problem solvers and not all game heads or gamers or whatever are like expert problem solvers, but many people who enjoy solving problems gravitate towards games because games are about this. And so a lot of these issues that we end up having with tutorialization and pedagogy have arisen now that in the modern era, we're trying to bring in more people into video games and people who are designing games don't know how to deal with that. Because if you look back to the 80s, we didn't have any of these extensive tutorials and things like that because games were primarily made for people who had a lot of time, who were going to sit around and explore and think about and really solve these problems in like very critical, aggressive ways. And now games are made for like everybody's mother and best friend and 8-year-old, you know, who may not have all of those abilities.
Right. So like you brought up the 80s. So would it be fair to say that like almost all of like the stuff that was happening in those early Infocom games are like non-routine problems?
Yeah, I think so. And another good example, which I will come back to, is Pac-Man is full of non-routine problems. Like, if you just think about, like, how you learned how to play Pac-Man. And in fact, a lot of, like, broad, successful games that had, like, huge appeal and were, like, big things for bringing the world into understanding what video games are, taught in a very different way than games teach now, which is kind of what the talk is about.
Okay. We'll let you keep.
Sure. Sorry, it's so much talking. So once we know what non-routine and routine problems are, I can skip a whole bunch of the talk. Because there's a whole bunch of stuff in the talk about just like thinking about like when you're playtesting a game, weird experiences that you might have, and how does that relate to people learn. But the important thing is there's another theory. So one theory of learning is called problem-solving theory, and that's where you have routine and non-routine, and you think about those things. The other theory of learning is called constructivism. And the way that constructivism works, and constructivism kind of gained prominence in the 80s and is now basically how everybody is taught everything, is that constructivist theory is about giving people a series of semi-routine problems and using that as a guide to bring them somewhere. So like, for example, if you're like, I want to learn C++, and you go out and buy a book that's called Teach Yourself C++ in 36 days, that book is constructivist. That idea that like, all right, I will give you this chapter and you'll know most of how this works, but you'll have to figure something out. And then I'll give you this chapter and you'll know most of how this works, but you have to figure this out. That's constructivism. Another example is how multiplication is typically taught these days is if you don't understand how to do multiplication, they'll first teach you counting. So you'll be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then they'll sit you in a circle with other people and they'll have you skip count. So they'll have the first person go 1, and then the second person goes 2, and then the third person goes 3, and then the fourth person goes 4. So you're like 2, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And so through watching that happen, you start to understand this sort of idea of moving by twos. And then you go into, well, what are the multiplication tables for twos? And then you go into memorizing the multiplication tables for twos. And so what they're doing is they're basically giving you like a ladder to climb up that will teach you how to understand multiplication. And this is a really big deal right now in video games, because how most tutorials work is this general structure. Here's how you do this thing. Try to do this thing that is this thing and maybe a little more. And then I will give you another piece of information and you will try to do that. And the thing about constructivism is it works really, really well if you need to learn a specific set of information, like algebra, and if you have a teacher who's really good at tailoring each step to every individual student. So like, if you're going to build a ladder, it can't be a one-size-fits-all ladder, because if you get a short person on it, they're going to have trouble reaching the stuff. And if you get a tall person on it, they're going to be like, there are too many rungs, this is like incredibly boring and complicated. And so constructivism is this very fantastic teaching structure, but it doesn't work very well when you don't have somebody who's sitting there with you, or when you don't design it impeccably well. And what I thought was really interesting about The Witness is The Witness is sort of constructivism taken to its theoretical conclusion. Like, The Witness is like, he was like, well, instead of having 5 steps, I'm going to make 600 steps, and people are going to do all the steps, and they're going to learn this amazing thing. And he did, you know, Jonathan Blow did an amazing job with that structure, but that structure is super constructivist. The alternative structure is teaching people to become good problem solvers. Which is arguably terrifying. And in fact, there are a lot of people who think that people can't become good problem solvers, that teaching problem solving is impossible. But there was some research done in the 80s, which actually my mom was involved with, which is how I found out about all this stuff, like last year, which was super weird to discover that I'm trying to figure out how to make games accessible. And she was like, oh, that's what I did my thesis on. So this idea is like, how do you teach someone to become a good problem solver? And so what they've discovered is that if you give someone a non-routine problem and you ask them to solve it, good problem solvers will predictably solve it well, and bad problem solvers will predictably not know what to do. They'll flounder. They'll do something called pattern matching, where they take something that they think used to be how to solve this problem. Like, you give someone a problem that's not exactly multiplication, but they'll try to solve it with multiplication, and then when they screw up, they won't know if they screwed up because they didn't understand the problem or if they applied multiplication wrong. So you end up having this sort of like weird loop that people go through when they don't understand something. So that is predictably what happens if you give someone a hard problem. But the magic happens when, if instead of giving someone a hard problem, you give them a bunch of constraints and you ask them to design the problem themselves. And so it turns out if you make people design their own problems,
and you give them constraints to force those problems to be complicated and as difficult as the sort of problems that you might design for them, they'll actually solve them as if they were expert problem solvers, which is totally bananas.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, and so personally, what I think is going on, which is total conjecture based on like my anecdotal experience, is that people have a lot of stress when they approach a problem, and they slack on the modeling of the problem in their head. But when you ask someone to design a problem for themselves, they have to deal with the modeling of the components before they deal with the problem. So when they actually get to the problem, they have a much deeper understanding of how all of the parts work. And where this really comes into play in games is in stuff like Pac-Man. So if you look at Pac-Man, Pac-Man is a game that is, there's no instructions. There's literally no text on the screen in Pac-Man that tells you anything helpful. It doesn't say, like, eat all the dots when you start a level of Pac-Man. And Pac-Man, on top of that, was designed in an era where they didn't have a target audience because it was the beginning of arcades. Their target audience was everybody who might have quarters in their pockets. So that is, like, anybody. And when you look at how Pac-Man works, it's really fascinating because Pac-Man gives you a bunch of tent poles right off the bat. So, like, the second you start moving Pac-Man, the dots are disappearing. So you understand immediately that when you move, you eat dots. You might not know that you have to eat all the dots to beat the level. You might not even know that there are levels, but you understand that eating dots is a thing that happens. And then the bad guys are ghosts, which look evil. And if they get you, it's really apparent that that they're bad, and they chase you in a way that feels menacing. And if you go to a giant blinking dot that is basically a thing yelling, like, come eat this, because it's blinking, all of the ghosts turn blue, and they flee from you in this very understandable way. And so what those things do is when somebody approaches the game of Pac-Man, there are a number of problems that they might design for themselves based around those constraints that the game imparts right away. So they might say, I want to eat all the ghosts. They might say, I want to eat all the dots. They might say, I want to eat the four dots in the corners. And what's beautiful about Pac-Man is any of those problems, when you then try to respond to that problem and do the thing, whether you succeed or fail, you're going to learn more about the goal of the game. So if you eat all the dots, you might go, oh, I got a lot of points, but oh, I see. Or if you eat all the blinking dots, you might go, oh, I got a lot of points and I ate all the ghosts, but now I don't have the dots to protect myself. So that clearly can't be the goal. I wonder what else there is. And then if you get all of the little dots first, then you go, oh, I see. If I get all of the little dots, I beat the level and now I get another level. And so it's a series of constraints that are lending themselves to the player generating a bunch of problems for themselves and then solving those problems and learning how to play the game. And so that, I think, is the most interesting way to teach. And it's very difficult because it has to be baked into the game itself and the design itself, but it basically allows people to reach depths of capability and problem solving and exploration that they wouldn't necessarily get to if you taught them in basically a ladder style constructivist approach.
Zach, I don't want to jump ahead in your talk, but one of the things that Pat and I talked about last week was, I was sort of contrasting like a treadmill game, like maybe like a mobile game or something, which is just sort of a game where like Candy Crush, right? Where you're sort of solving this problem, and the more progress you make, the harder the problem gets. But there's nothing really fundamentally new about it. And I was sort of contrasting that with a game like Overwatch or Spelunky, which I was talking about, like the Bernie Dukovin's well-played game analogy, which is like a game becomes excellent because of the way that you play it. And for me, as when I get really into a game and, thinking about like basically like Spelunky and Overwatch are the games I've been the most into in the last decade. For me, like I kind of like need that as to get into the game. And I get, it's the only way I personally sort of have like an artistic connection with a game or like a meaningful connection to the game where I feel like I'm learning something about myself or I'm learning something about the human condition or I'm improving as a person. Like it's that level of like meaningfulness that I get, when I'm interacting with those games that like challenge you to play them well or figure it out on your own terms. Is that true for you as well as like a consumer of games?
Yeah, I mean, those are certainly the games that I like the most. I haven't played very much of Overwatch, but Spelunky and that ilk of game. But I think also you have to be careful when you're drawing comparisons to something like Candy Crush, because Candy Crush is like a very... there's a lot happening in that game. And so there are a lot of things happening in Candy Crush that are like deeply sinister. And if you understand how game mechanics work, it's terrifying.
All right. Well, as promised, that is the conclusion of our very dry and academic discussion of games that we like. We'll be back next week with the thrilling conclusion of that conversation. One more reminder, Pat and I will both be at PAX West over the next week. So you can find us there and tell us how much you love the podcast. And we're going to try and get together and record a few episodes live. So there may be an opportunity to join us for that. We may do like a meetup in a coffee shop or a hotel lobby or something. So just stay tuned to our Twitter. You can follow me. I'm at Max Temkin, and Pat is at Patrick Rothfuss. See you guys next week.